Okay, so you should have these four handouts. I hope you signed up for a lab section. If you didn't, you can do it after class. You should have some homework to turn in, but we'll do that same time you turn in your quiz. So, kind of no surprise, it's a quiz on scale models. Six in a little bit different way. One. Another couple of minutes. another minute or so. So you want to make sure you got your names on this and on your homework. I'm going to turn them all in together, one big blob. Okie doke, send them this away when you're ready. I got them all. So the scale model homework, your answer should look kind of like that, right? These big circles that represent the orbits of the planets. So this one was the orbit of Mercury, and Venus is about twice as big, and it works out kind of like that. For the quiz we just took, this kind of scale model quiz, we've got an alien, and the problem says that the alien is 4 alien units big, and we've got a spacecraft, and it says that the spacecraft is 6 alien units long, and we've measured the spacecraft. It's also 8 meters long. And we're supposed to figure out how big the alien is. And, you know, without doing any calculations, just trying to estimate things to start with, it's clear that the alien is a little bit smaller than the spacecraft. So I don't know, 5, 6, something like that might be kind of a reasonable guess. And if we don't get something like that, then we should be worried. You know, the name of the game is to set things in proportions. So we don't know how big the alien is. We can call whatever that is X, and then we set up proportions. And, you know, here's the sort of thing we did last time. It kind of doesn't matter how we do it. We can take this is to this as 4 alien units is to 6 alien units. And then from what you learned in algebra, something in the denominator on one side becomes the numerator on the other. So this is x is equal to 4 alien units times 8 meters divided by 6 alien units. In terms of units, the alien units cancel out. And what we've got is 32.6. And the answer is going to be meters. And that's a perfectly good answer. You could run that through your calculator. You'll get 5 1/3 or 5.3, something like that, meters, right? Which pretty much fits our estimates. So if you have this, that's all I really care about, right? So the final answer you wrote down is of considerably less import than kind of how you got the answer. More questions? Okay, so I think five of you have failed to do the pretest, so kind of let me remind you how that works. This is the class website, www.physics.csbsu.edu.astro, and we'll be doing lots of things here, and in particular, this pretest is what was assigned for last time. So if you're in the five who didn't do that, if you can get that done by, I don't know, Saturday, something like that, that'll be good. So generally speaking, stuff is always due the next day, but for the online stuff, I don't care whether you turn it in up until the time I actually get around to grading it. So usually you've got a grace period of at least a few hours if you've forgotten to do it. Questions on that? So here, I don't care what you wrote. I only care whether you did it or not. So this is the pretest and the post-test version of this. I will care how you did on it, hopefully better than you did on the first one. So we're going to be spending lots of time here, and the first thing that we're going to be doing is this tutorial and quiz on the sky map. And this is a whole series of, I don't know, 20 or something like that, short explanations for things. And then finally it ends with this online quiz. So you'll take that online quiz and hopefully complete that homework. Questions? So you should have signed up for a lab time that works for you. It looks like we're a little bit short just from quickly counting the numbers. You can do that after class. One thing to remember is that you write down those lab times yourself, right? Because the list is actually going to stay in the classroom. So if you call me up and ask me, you know, what lab section you're in, I won't know. Have to come over here and check it out. So do carefully write down what's what. In addition to those labs at the observatory, you now have this home lab manual. And what you have to do here is to schedule yourself to make a series of observations. The observations are kind of arbitrarily put into two groups, lab one and lab two. Lab one, you have to follow the cycle of the moon, which takes about a month. In lab two, we're looking at how the seasons change, and so we need to have at least a couple of months of data. So in some sense, you can start any of these labs anytime, but because lab one takes less total time, just a month, you could start it later if you want. So the kind of absolute last start dates for lab one, October 10th, is actually after the absolute latest start date for lab two, which maybe is confusing. The best thing, of course, would be if you started both of these labs tomorrow, right? But usually it doesn't work out that way. So the first lab has to do with the moon, and what you're supposed to do is, from the class website, print out this big table of moon rise and set times. Because if you're going to observe the moon, it's nice to know when you can actually see it, right? Half of the time it's above the horizon, half of the time it's below the horizon. So if you pick at random, you only have a 50-50 chance of seeing the moon. You combine that with a 50-50 chance of the weather being okay, and you're going to miss an awful lot of the time. So from this sort of chart, you can pick out times when you can actually see the moon if it's clear. And then you can make your observations that are required for the lunar lab. For the lab two, what you're going to be doing is looking at the stars around the North Celestial Pole. And if you're not familiar with those constellations, you may want to wait till after the first lab to do that. That's kind of why it has a slightly later start date. But the longer time between the start and the end of lab two, the better it'll work out for you. So if you do know where the Big Dipper is and where Little Dipper is and where Cassiopeia is, then you're all set to do lab two, and you could start that ASAP also. For lab two, the things that give people problems, I think, as much as anything else, is just knowing the cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west. And if you're in some dark site, knowing which way north is so that you can follow these constellations. So if you don't have one of these applications that shows you the directions of north, then kind of know which way directions of north is. Both of the campuses are kind of oriented north-south, and you can see in this room the cardinal directions are labeled north, south, east, and west. And so generally speaking, towards I-94 at St. John's is north. Questions? Well, so there, it's highly variable, and so what you do is you go out and you sketch the sky, and you know there are problems with that, particularly for the North Circumpolar constellations, in that it's definitely going to be dark. The moon is up half of the time during the day, so it's easy to sketch when you can see what you're sketching. It's a little bit harder to sketch when you can't see what you're sketching. So you're probably going to need a flashlight and a dark sight, and literally sketching, you know, probably, if you know what you're doing, probably is only going to take 10 minutes. So it's a matter of going outside of your dorm room, finding a dark spot, and sketching. But, you know, that's the ideal world. I would think that probably a half an hour is going to be a better guess as to how long it's going to take. And that's fine to do with a group, right? It can be kind of scary to go out in some dark spot and look at the sky, no lights around. So, you know, it's fine to do that in a group. But have everyone do their own sketches if you do it in a group. None of you are scared, huh? I don't know. It's online, right? So if you go to the class website, the kind of start for everything, moonrise set time. More questions? Okay. So I think we're done with the online stuff. Looks like they cleaned the filter, which is good. So remember what I said last time is the way the board is usually set up is I've got the assignments for what's due next time over here, and over here I have a review of stuff that would be important to know for the next exam. So what did we talk about last time? Well, we talked about these three words, which are sometimes mixed up by people, right? So the universe is everything that's observable, touchable, that light that we could get light from. The galaxy is our collection of stars. The universe is made out of literally zillions of galaxies, collections of more than a billion stars per galaxy. In our case, more than 100 billion stars per in our galaxy. Galaxies are generally speaking made up of stars, and we think that probably most stars have planets that going around them. And so a star with planets going around it is called a solar system. We live in the solar system, just as we actually live in capital G galaxy as opposed to a typical galaxy. Okay, solar system is the stuff that NASA can visit. Galaxies are what you can see basically with your naked eye. That is to say, it's pretty hard to see distant galaxies. There's maybe one galaxy besides our own that you can see with your naked eye. So mostly if you're looking at stuff in the sky, you're looking at stuff in our galaxy. So we're going to be dealing with numbers, not hugely in this class, but a little bit, so it's kind of important to know how they work. So first of all, we're almost always going to be using the metric system. So that's the system where the meter, the thing that's about a yard, is the basis of it. And since we're going to be looking at both big stuff and small stuff, we need to put lots of meters together. So the kilometer is the thing that's a little bit short of a mile that you'll see all the time in Europe and in Canada, every place else except here. So we have capital M, like in megamol, for a million of something. So a megameter would be a million meters. And we have G for a billion of something, 10 to the ninth of something, one followed by nine zeros of something. Going the other way, we've got milli, a thousandth. So a millimeter is a thousandth of a meter. A micrometer, that's kind of the size of a cell, would be a millionth of a meter, and a nanometer would be a billionth of a meter. So in typical scientific notation, we're going to express things as a basis number and then a power of 10. And on your calculator, there's usually a button labeled something like EE, and that's used to put in the exponent. A pretty common mistake to make is if you're entering a number like 10 to the fifth, is instead of doing this, doing that, right? You'll be wrong if you do that, right? Because it's 1 times 10 to the fifth, not 10 times 10 to the fifth. And then, of course, we've seen that the kind of the main story here is putting things in proportion to make scale models. And once we put things in proportion, it's kind of interesting to see what things change and what things don't. So something that doesn't change, that's an invariant. And we talked about angles in your scale model as being an example of that. So because angles are invariant, we're going to be spending a whole lot of time measuring angles in the sky. If you look at the cover of your front book, it shows somebody measuring the angles of stars in the sky. So extensive variables are the sorts of things that more of it is more, like mass or volume or height. Intensive quantities are things that are scale invariant. And a common way of making an intensive property is to take two things that are extensive and just divide them, right? So kind of the more cancels out. So the standard example of it is density, where it's just mass divided by volume. So the density of Fort Knox worth of gold and a little piece of gold are the same. Right? Even though obviously Fort Knox is worth a whole lot more than the little cavity filler that fell out of my mouth. Temperature is another example of an intensive quantity, right? If you have more object that's hot, it still has the same temperature as a small object that's hot. Okay, questions on last time? Well, we got this list of handouts, and you've seen kind of the list of topics that are online. You can see kind of the plan for this mod, particularly before the first lab, is to learn how to map things in the sky. And what we're going to be working on is getting to understand all of these terms. And we'll work on them kind of one at a time. And this is kind of two versions of our starting star map. So let's first of all start with the terms that we've got here, at least the first section of the terms. Well, let's start actually with the horizon system, because I think that's going to be the easiest. What we need are names for the directions, and of course we're used to having north, south, east, and west, but we're interested in the sky, so we're going to need a direction that's up too. So the name of the direction that's straight up, so wherever you are on the Earth, if you point straight up, you're pointing at zenith. We won't need too much the name for the opposite word, which is nadir. So if you're pointing straight down, then that's part of nadir. So the horizon is where the sky ends and the ground begins. And of course, realistically, the horizon is going to be interrupted by buildings and trees and things like that. So often we're interested in kind of the mathematical horizon. If you bulldozed the campus flat, then there would be a big circle that would represent the area where the sky meets the ground. And on this map, this circle represents the horizon. And here, to kind of remind you of it, they've put some small hills and valleys around the edge. Same thing on this map here, the circle, the edge of the circle is supposed to represent the horizon. And of course, the piece of the sky that's furthest from the horizon, that's going to be the zenith. So right in the center of these maps, that's where zenith is going to be. Now, in some sense, kind of the most important line in the sky is what's called the meridian. So in our sky, the meridian is going to go from north. North celestial pole turns out to be about 45 degrees above the north end of the horizon, up through zenith and back through south. Okay, so on this map, this is the north part of the horizon. There's the north celestial pole. Here's zenith and here's south. So the meridian is a line that goes right like that on this map. Now, sometimes it's helpful to have kind of a representation of the sky, and that's what this sphere is supposed to be. So here you can see the cardinal directions, north, east, south, and west, and we've got a dinosaur that's looking at the sky. So this spot here would be zenith, the direction straight up according to that dinosaur. And the meridian would be the line in the sky that goes from north through the north celestial pole, through zenith, and back through south. Okay, a vertical circle. So if you turn in any particular direction and you look straight up, you're looking at part of a vertical circle. Right? So a vertical circle is any place you go on the horizon, go straight up. Right? And of course, if you go straight up far enough, you'll eventually reach zenith. So typically when we're orienting ourselves, we're going to be talking about turning in some direction and then going up a certain number of degrees on a vertical circle. Right? So again, according to the dinosaur, a vertical circle would be one that goes straight up, and so it would go right through zenith. It's kind of helpful to distinguish between great circles and little circles on spheres. So a little circle is any circle that's smaller than the actual sphere circle. And a great circle is any circle that has a radius that's equal to the radius of the sphere. So these vertical circles are great circles that go through zenith. The meridian is a particular great circle that goes through zenith, one that is oriented north-south. Altitude and azimuth. So we just said that if you're going to orient yourself in the sky, you're going to turn at some angle and then you're going to look up. So those two angles are azimuth and altitude. So the altitude is the angle you have to look up from the horizon to reach your star, and the azimuth is the angle you have to turn to from north in order to reach the base of that vertical circle. So with those two numbers, azimuth and altitude, you can point at any direction in the sky. Okay, so I skipped over kind of intentionally diurnal circle. So here's kind of a flat representation. It's kind of hard to make drawings, and you'll see very much online that it's hard to make drawings that depict this sort of thing. So this thing is supposed to be pretty much the same as this representation. And what we have here, of course, are the cardinal directions, north, east, south, and west, and zenith, straight up. The meridian is the line in the sky that goes from north through the north celestial pole through zenith and back through south. Now it turns out that the stars all seem to be turning around the north celestial pole. So, and it's turning in such a way so that generally speaking things are going to be rising in the east and setting in the west, right? So that's why the sun and the moon, all of those guys, generally speaking, rise in the east and set in the west. The stars around the north celestial pole, they're going to go in circles around the north celestial pole, right? It's easier to show it in three dimensions. So if this is the north celestial pole, we're going to have a little circle like that for example, the Big Dipper. Right? So the Big Dipper is going to move like that in our sky, always circling, roughly speaking, one revolution per day. Okay, so the path of a star during 24 hours, that's what a diurnal circle is. Diurnal means daily. So here's a diurnal circle that starts at exactly the east point and therefore sets at exactly the west point. There'd be a parallel line to that, kind of like that. And there'd be things that look like circles that would be diurnal circles there. Something that is way down here, its diurnal circle is going to be pretty small. And it's never going to get very high.
The north celestial pole be a different location in the sky for someone who's in China?
Yes. So we'll talk more about that in the future, but what is true is that if you can see the north celestial pole, and you can't in the southern hemisphere, the north celestial pole will have an altitude above the north point that's equal to your latitude. So here at St. John's, the latitude is about 45 degrees, and that's why the north celestial pole has an altitude of 45 degrees. As you go south, the north celestial pole would get closer and closer to the horizon. And on the equator, it would be right at the horizon. If you go south, then the south celestial pole would pop up above the southern horizon. Does that make sense? There is a question over here. Clear it up. Okay. So I'm sure you know that totally randomly, that is to say there's no real logic to it, people have put together the stars in the sky in terms of these constellations. And different cultures have done it different ways, and we've kind of inherited the Greek way of doing it, so a lot of these are kind of Greek names for various things. So this, for example, is the constellation Pegasus, and you can see it being labeled Pegasus there. We also have stars that are being labeled. So this particularly big bright dot represents Vega. And the way these maps are supposed to work is the bigger the dot, the brighter the star. So this little dot here is supposed to be not nearly as bright as Vega is. If we want to put a number to a star, we do it in terms of magnitudes, and it's done in a really funny way, basically because it dates back to the Greeks. It goes backwards. So that a star that you can just barely see would be a fifth magnitude star, and as you go brighter, things get more and more negative. So the sun, for example, I think it's something like a minus 25 magnitude star, right? It's pretty bright compared to anything else. The brightest star in our sky is Sirius. Which is up more in winter, so that's why it's not on this map. It has a magnitude of about minus 1.5. So Vega, for example, has a magnitude that's about zero. And it's going to be one of the brighter things in our sky currently.
Okay. So did they set zero to be like Vega intentionally?
So no. So astronomy, I don't know, for better or worse, is really tied to history. And so it goes back to way before Christ, when we had Greek astronomers kind of arbitrarily saying that the brightest stars in our sky are first magnitude, and the next brightest stars are second magnitude, next brightest are third magnitude. And they just made those numbers up based on how they looked. And when people came to figure out how they were, when people used instruments to measure the brightness of stars, they were kind of looking for some sort of correspondence. And they found that they had underestimated the brightest stars. They really were way brighter than they were saying. Sirius is way brighter than anything else in the sky. So when we extended their system, which originally had just 1, 2, 3, and 4, to make in-between numbers and to include these brightest stars, that's where we started getting negative numbers. Well, so just like a light bulb, how bright something appears to be depends on how big the light bulb is and how close it is to you. So what we're talking about is sometimes called the apparent magnitude of a star. And it's not an intrinsic property of the star. It depends on the particulars. Its diameter, its temperature, its location. And also its time of life, right? So the sun seems to be particularly bright not because it's a particularly bright star. It's actually a fairly average star. It's bright just because we're way, 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 way closer to it than any other star. So not uncommonly people ask, well, kind of what's the most important feature, the actual brightness of the star or the distance from it? And the answer is yes. It really is a pretty important mix. So if you look at the stars, most of the bright stars in our sky are bright because they are intrinsically bright. But Alpha Centauri, which happens not to be a star that we see, it's a southern hemisphere star, it's a very bright star, and it's bright because it's a star like the sun, pretty average, but very close to us. So it's a mix. Distance and kind of wattage of the star both matter in kind of equal amounts. More questions? So, of course, one of the things we've had to do with going beyond the Greeks with telescopes is we make these numbers now go way dimmer. So we've extended that magnitude system. So about the dimmest stars we can see now are about magnitude 30 with the Hubble, very deep exposures with Hubble. About as good as you can do with binoculars is maybe 10 or 11. And your eye kind of 5 or 6, depending upon the situation. More questions? Okay, so if you look at this map here, you'll see one additional circle. We've got the diurnal circle that goes right from the east point to the west point, And that's given the special name the celestial equator because it's 90 degrees from the celestial pole. And there's also this other line here that's shown. It's a little bit below it. And if you notice, there are lots of special symbols that are pretty close to that line. So these are planets, and this is the moon. And you can see that generally speaking, the planets, the moon, and the sun, if it were light outside, they tend to stay pretty close to this line, which is called the ecliptic. Okay, so planets are found near the ecliptic. And why, of course, is a question for the future. So this is the celestial equator. Notice that its units are pretty funny. Everything ends in an H for some reason. But again, we'll need to talk about it in the future. And this guy here is the ecliptic. The celestial equator goes from exactly from the west point to exactly the east point. Okay, so what's the difference between these two maps? They're mostly the same. What's the difference? Well, one difference I hope is immediately apparent. This thing is very particular, right? So the latitude and longitude that that map is taken at and the time at which that map is taken, those things are all there to lots of significant digits. This map here, they say it's more or less good for September. It's designed to be good for about 40 degrees latitude. Remember, we're at 45 degrees latitude. And if you notice in detail, the time involved kind of switches, right? At the end of September, that's relevant to 8 p.m., and at the beginning of September, it's 9 p.m. So this map here is designed to be kind of an average, approximate version of what the sky is going to look like, roughly speaking, in September, whereas this map here is supposed to be very particular and very accurate. So things like the moon, which over a month change radically in their position, you can't have the position of the moon on average during a month, so it's not listed. So here we have exactly where the moon is on this date and at this date and time. Okay, so this one here, so this is universal coordinate time, which is pretty much the same thing as the time at Greenwich, England. So that's why it may seem like kind of a funny time to be observing, but it actually corresponds to 9 p.m. Local time. And you can see there's a pretty good matchup. If you look in detail, you'll see things are a little bit different. Notice that Pegasus is relatively close to the horizon here. It's a little bit further away there. Okay, so these things are supposed to be, roughly speaking, maps of the same thing. This is kind of an average map that would be good approximately for a month. This is a particular map that is very accurate for one particular time. Okay, questions? So the plan at this point is for you to break up into groups of three, and I want you to actually be able to stare at your partners in the face, so probably turning around or moving is going to be better than just taking three people in a row, and work on a little project for dealing with these maps. So collect yourself together into groups of three. When I see a group of three, I'll give you a sheet of paper. You guys are a group of three. You guys are a group of three. Are you out?
Apparently.
You have to find partners. Looks like there's a group of three there. So is this three here? Who are you with? Two groups of two? There's an odd guy over there. He looks odd to me. So, I don't know, you can be a group of two. You can join these guys here to be a group of three guys. Wouldn't want to get cooties. So everyone's in a group of three? Or two? So you want to circle them, of course, here so they get turned in.
Yeah.
Right? Yep. Okay. So you're just finding them there first.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can probably clean this off.